thank you to, I want to say a quick thank you to Kevin and anybody else who was involved in inviting the guest speakers during this time for thinking of me. It is an honor to share this space with you. Full disclosure, I did not read any of the scriptures today when I was planning what I was going to say to you. So this may be a little bit disconnected. I want to say I'm sorry about it, but I'm not forgetting. It's a theme to say sorry if it's not connected, but what I do want to say, though, when I was thinking of what I wanted to say, I kind of took an easy route, and I am going to share with you two of my favorite lessons that I taught my kids at Fort Christian. So bear with. These two in particular I wanted to share because something that's been on my heart is God's relational intent, that God intends to be relational with us. And the first of these lessons that I would share with my kids comes at creation. And when I was first taught creation, the story of creation, it was, well, I can't remember if it was explicitly said or implied that God created everything from nothing. That God created, the Latin phrase is ex nihilo, out of nothing, right? And we get that primarily, well, I can't say primarily, but one of the things that reinforces that teaching is Genesis 1, verse 2, the earth was formless and void. Formless meaning without any shape, and void meaning empty. So if something is empty and has no shape, probably is nothing. And so God saw emptiness, a nothingness, and created somethingness, right? So that's the idea. And I'm not trying to say that God did not do that. That's not what I'm saying. I firmly believe that God created ex nihilo. However, if we kind of have this sort of material lens in which we read Genesis 1, I have questions. Because immediately after the earth was formless and void, it said darkness was over the deep. And then the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So if God created something from nothing, what is the deep? What are the waters? Another question I have is the idea of how could we have evening and morning on days 1, 2, 3 if the sun and the moon, which tell us when evening and morning isn't created until day 4? That seems to, like, it was there a sun before the sun? What did God in Revelation is said to be eternal light, so that he turns it off during the evening times? So there's confusion, right? And I think that skeptics of Christianity and even the Bible, particularly when they are told that God creates out of nothing, they have, rightfully, these questions. What do you mean God created something from nothing when there clearly was mentioned a something? And I was pondering these questions while I was at Multnomah with a teacher, and he asked, have you ever considered that maybe it's not Genesis 1, the text is not talking about material creation? And I hadn't considered that because that was different than what I was taught. I was taught that different is bad. So, no, I had not considered that. He was like, read this book. And it was this book by an author, John H. Walton, called The Lost World of Genesis 1. And it changed my life. Because in this book, Walton challenges this notion of reading Genesis 1 through a material lens. What things did God create? And rather, he asked us to look at Genesis 1 through a different lens. The first of these challenges comes from taking the formless and void text in Hebrew and doing a word study. It's a fun phrase to say in Hebrew. It's tohu vabohu. You want to say that with me? Let's go. Tohu vabohu. It's fun. It's a fun phrase to say. My mom's favorite phrase in Spanish was vacas flacas, skinny cows. So, tohu vabohu, right? It's a fun phrase to say. Tohu, I believe, is the word that is mentioned in the entire Old Testament something around 25 times. Bohu is a separate word, and it's mentioned 3 times in the Old Testament, always in the phrase tohu. Tohu, when you look at all the contexts in which it is written throughout the Old Testament, has 3 categories of definitions: a trackless waste, a useless argument, or an idol. Now, again, this is the phrase that we translate formless and void. None of those things seem to carry with it this idea of material nothing. A trackless waste is something that you can see. You can't really traverse, you can't plant, you can't live there, but you can obviously see it. A useless argument requires 2 or more people, who are things, I think, to have. And an idol, we know what God feels about idols. So if formless and void isn't supposed to be interpreted as a material nothingness, what instead is it talking about? And I think it's talking about function, purpose. A trackless waste has no purpose. You can't walk through it. You can't build on it. You can't plant it. You can't live there. A useless argument only creates division and strife and contention. An idol is a thing that you worship, that you made with your own hands. And it seems kind of weird that the creator would worship the created thing. So it's pointless. There's no purpose. So if we take that definition, those things, and put it back into the text, then the fact that there is a deep in waters doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there's already a something there. What God saw was a world without purpose, a world without function. And the next thing is that he kind of centers on in his book, Walton does, is that Genesis 1 reads like a temple construction. He used archaeology and contemporary sources, even 1 Kings when Solomon was building the temple. And there's a generic pattern that was followed throughout. And that basically, I'm boiling it down to very basic terms here. But basically, when you build a temple at that time, you lay a foundation, you put up walls and make rooms, and then you fill those rooms with details. So the things that either function within those rooms or the beings that operate within those rooms. So think of the temple in 1 Kings. You have the foundation, then you have the holy place and the most holy place, the rooms. And then you have the lampstand and the table for the bread and the incense altar in one room. And then you have the ark and the holy room, right? So you have all these, you have the foundation rooms details. And so if he is correct, or I don't want to say correct, if his interpretation has any weight, then we should see that within the text. So on day one, let's go start there. Day one, God created light. That is the thing that God created. But then he said that there was evening and morning. And day two, there's also evening and morning. And day three and four and so on, there's evening. Morning, evening, morning, and so on and so forth, and for all time. So when God created light, he created time. And I'm pretty sure we all can at least understand the idea that time is the foundation for everything in our lives. It tells us when to wake up, when to go to sleep, when to eat, when to work, when to take a lunch break. It tells us when to plant, when to harvest. It shows us aging, right? So as we grow older, we have this physical representation of the passage of time. So when God created light, he created time. And time is foundational. So then, if that is the foundation, we should expect rooms. Day two, he separated water from water. We have sky, we have sea. Day three, he separated land from the water. We have land. Bonus, vegetation also happens on day three. So now we have rooms. Now we need to fill in the details. Notice the symmetry. Day one is light, day four, sun, moon, and stars are created. Those are the things that allow us to tell the time. Day two, sky and sea. Day five, birds and fish, the things that operate within those rooms. Day three was land. Day six is beasts. Bonus on both vegetation and human beings, right? So now we have the details filling in the rooms. But here's the kicker. Here's the thing that really kind of makes this impactful. A temple cannot be active until the deity lives or is present in the temple. We saw this in 1 Kings. When the temple was fully online, the temple filled with smoke, and that showed everybody that God is here. He lives here. This is now his home. And the English word that we have used to translate that idea is rest. So on the seventh day, God lived in his temple. And so I tell my kids, the universe is God's temple. And you are his masterpiece. Created last, you always. I don't know why anybody said it opens the best present first. You always save the best for last. And God made us last. He made us in his image. And in Genesis 2, there's a detailed description where instead of God speaking us into existence, he formed us with his hands. Because God desires to be with his creation. It's a relational intent. The second lesson happens thousands of years into the future. Not from our time, from creation. So quick history. So we have the creation, we have the flood, we have the genealogy technique. Abraham's grandson, Jacob, grows old and he takes his family into Egypt where they live for roughly 400 years. They become a nation, a massive group of people. Moses comes and leads them out to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, God says, if you accept me, if you follow my commands, my words, then I will be your God, you will be my people. The people said, yes, and then immediately started crying. And wilderness wanderings happened, and that generation didn't make it to the promised land. Seriously, they were whiny babies. One of the things they said was, we might as well go back to Egypt where we were enslaved, because at least we had a variety of food. It's an actual complaint. So that generation didn't make it. The next generation comes, Joshua leads them in the conquest of the land, and then after he goes, the people are settled. Right now they can become tribal, and we have the period of judges. The period of judges lasts about 300 years, and over the course of judges we see this repeating cycle. There's peace in the land, and because they didn't completely remove the people from the land as God prophesied would happen, the people began to practice idolatry. Now, it wasn't like full-blown 100% idolatry. It was more syncretistic. You can imagine a conversation with a spouse. Hey, what holidays do you celebrate? Oh, that doesn't fall immediately on mine. We can do both. Right? So it was this syncretistic of merging two religions together, and God called that idolatry. And so they would fall into idolatry. Then God would raise up to oppress them, for the purpose to have them cry out to God to save them. God would send a judge, and he would save them, and there would be peace in the land. And when the judge passed, then they would fall into idolatry, and then oppression, and then cry out, and then saving, and then peace, and then, and it happens like five times throughout Judges. 300-year period. And then Samson comes along. He's one of the last judges. And Samson's sole purpose, if we look at who he wasn't that great of a person. But his whole purpose was to stir up trouble between Israel and the Philistines. Because when the oppression happened with the Philistines, a growing majority of Israel was saying, we might as well just be like them. They're stronger militarily, they have a better government, they have a king who actually can tell them what to do, so they're obviously better, we might as well just be like them. God was like, no, here's Samson. And Samson just causes trouble. And while he is causing trouble, we have the maturation and growth of Samuel. Samuel comes, and Samuel is the first central figure in Israel to really unite all of the clans, all of the tribes, since maybe Moses. And Samuel had two sons who weren't the best, and the people were like, we're not going to have this hereditary rule. And so Samuel, when you go, we want a king to replace you. And Samuel's like, no, you don't. You don't want that. That's not what this whole experiment is supposed to be. That's not the plan. And this, people are like, yes, we do. Everybody else has a king. We want to be like everybody else. And Samuel's like, I am upset. And God says, they're not replacing you. They're replacing me. And that was the whole point of Israel. They were supposed to be different. And they were supposed to be different so good that everybody would want to be a part of it. But they kind of got into their own heads and they wanted to be like everybody else. They thought that strength and power and governance through a king was better because they saw the technological advancements and all these other things. We keep on getting oppressed by these people failing to remember that God saved them every single time. So I want a king. They're not replacing you, they're replacing me. So give them what they want. And Samuel says, listen, this is what a king's going to require. You're going to have to send your sons to be his soldiers, to be his commanders, to build his palaces, his fortresses. You're going to have to send your daughters to be his servants and his wives. You're going to have to pay him a tax on top of the tithe that you already give to God. You're going to have to do all he can take your land for these building projects. You don't know what you're asking. And they say, we want a king. And so finally, in Samuel's farewell address, 1 Samuel chapter 12, finally Samuel says, what have I done wrong to lead you down this path? And the people say, you haven't done anything wrong. And Samuel says, thank you for saying that. This is all the things that you have done wrong. And so he goes through and he reminds them, it was God and God alone who brought you out of Egypt. And you want a king? It was God and God alone who saved you every time these disparate bands of oppression happened to you. God did that. And you want a king? And then after his farewell address, this last little thing, this thunderous crash happens, and the people are terrified, and they realize in that moment that they had messed up. They messed up, and they messed up bad, and they plead to Samuel, plead on our behalf. We can't speak to God. We're terrified of him. He's going to kill us. Please speak on our behalf, or we will die. And Samuel says this, and this is kind of where we're home. In 1 Samuel 12, verse 20, Samuel says this, do not be afraid. You have done this evil. And I think I appreciate that a lot. That there wasn't a, it's okay, no worries. We'll figure it out. you know, God is forgiving, it's all good. Samuel says, no, you messed up. And with them, it was major. They permanently changed their relationship with God for the worse. God is now going to further remove himself from them. He is no longer going to speak to them directly. He is now going to have to speak to them through the king. And if you know anything about the kings of Israel's history, most of them were terrible. And they didn't speak God's word. It was a result of this action. Samuel says, don't be afraid, you're not going to die. You done messed up. And you messed up big time. But he continues. He says, however, do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve him with all your heart. Don't turn to other things that can deliver. Those things are empty. God will not forsake his people for his own name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. Even when they said, I don't want you to rule over me. I want a fallible, imperfect human being to be the one to tell me what to do. God said, yeah, you messed up. But don't stop. Because I am pleased to have you, even with the mess ups, be a part of my people. And that, for me, is so profound, because it removes the necessity for guilt and shame. There are consequences. God never said there weren't consequences. They permanently changed their relationship with him for the worse. And it led to a whole series of just really awful things, to the point where God removed them from the land that he had promised them, because they were no longer stewards of the land that his ship had been. So these actions have consequences, some long-lasting. But God said, don't stop, because I am pleased to have you be a part of my people. And I think that has... Often when I get a chance to speak in front of you all, you hear me say that I'm not worthy. And often I think that because I think that my mess ups are so great that the lie, the temptation to believe the lie that how could God love or accept someone who does this. But every time I start to go down there, I think of this. Because no matter how big my mess-ups are, no matter how big your mess-ups are, and you are the judge of how big or small your mess-ups are, but no matter how big they are, God says, don't stop. And to me, that is the epitome of relational intent. God desires to be with us, even when we mess up. He still wants to be with us. He still wants to have a relationship with us. And he has won that